Call the in-state energy meeting to order at 7:30 this morning. Present are Senators Machicki, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilikowski, myself, my staff, Pete Feldman is here, and myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to recognize the staff today, Christopher Dickrell. Lori Berg is our LIO moderator. And today we're having Mr. Bill Walker, Mr. Craig Richards for the Alaska Gasline Port Authority. I've asked Bill and Greg to come to the committee today and present an overview of the Alaska LNG project and the Port Authority. And gentlemen, please proceed. Let the record reflect Senator Egan has joined us. And welcome to Juneau, and thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present to you today. Thank you for the invitation. I'm Bill Walker with Walker Richards, here presenting on behalf of the Alaska Gasline Port Authority. You know, we're going to walk through some slides some of you have seen before. You know, you do something for 25 years or so, somebody's going to see that you've done it in the previous time, but now LNG seems to be the scene, everybody's talking about it. So we're glad to hear the discussion about it, and we're glad to be able to contribute to the discussion. I'm going to move rather quickly. We have a lot of slides today. I'm going to move quickly. I certainly welcome any questions and as we go through it.
Thank you. I'd like the record reflect Senate President Huggins is here with us, just joined us, and the Speaker of the House, Mr. Mike Chenault. Thank you.
Very good. Port Authority formed in 1999, North Slope Borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, City of Valdez. One of the first tasks they did is a trip to Asia. I believe in 2002, I think Port Authority Chairman Dave Cobb is here, and he was a part of that first trip with Bechtel. So that was our first entree into the market. If there's anything we've learned in the Asian market, they don't have a drive-up window. You go and establish relationships over many, many years, and that's exactly what we have done. The project, it's the same project that we've looked at for many, many years, the same project that was the voter mandate in Proposition 2. And following the taps right away with the spur line from Glen Allen over into South Central. You know, a lot of questions have come up. Why did you select that route? Well, it sort of match up with the entities of the Port Authority, but also it's a route that was selected by TAPS, selected by El Paso, selected by Yukon Pacific Corporation, looked at by many companies as far as the most permittable route. And when you're going to have that kind of a dollar project, you want to have a route that you're reasonably sure is going to be permitted. I'm not going to go through these permits. These are the permits that were obtained by Yukon Pacific Corporation for this very route. We're not saying another route couldn't be possible, couldn't get permitted someplace else. This is the one that was permitted. So rather than trying to reinvent something, we continue to follow the route that received the federal EIS, the federal right-of-way, state right-of-way, export license, etc. So it was a period of over about 12 years. $100 million was expended when the company created by Governor Egan and Governor Hickel. We have been told by many that have looked at this, Bechtel, Williams, BG, that it's not the permits so much as the data that was collected. I don't believe any of these permits are current today. In fact, I'm sure they're not. The fact that they were obtained gives you an indication that most likely they'd be obtained, more likely than not, they'd be it would be obtained again. So there's been some discussion about if you get to Valdez,
Mr. Walker, just a couple questions. One of the things we've been trying to do this year is cover acronyms well for the public. Just a couple on the page, TAGS and MT.
Yeah, TAGS is Trans-Alaska Gas System. That was the acronym for the Yukon Pacific project. And I'm sorry, the second one?
At the bottom bullet, LNG MT facility.
LNG MC, MT, Marine Terminal. So I'm sorry.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr.
Chairman. Just for clarification, Bill, you said that the TAGS was the EIS. You said that was part of a permitting process, but probably is not a valid one. Is that what you're?
That's correct.
Okay, all right.
that process has stopped to be advanced. The data is there, but the actual print itself has expired. There was some discussion about if you get once you get to Port Valdez, where would you put the terminal? The West Tank Farm is completely shut down at this point, completely disconnected. We hired a company out of Houston that their specialty is siting LNG terminals. They've done a fair amount of work in Australia. They looked at the Allianz Marine Terminal and felt that the West Tank Farm former location would be an appropriate location for that. This was actually not our idea. It came to us from the Joint Pipeline Office, a representative from Alaska, Jerry Brosia, and his supervisor from Washington, D.C., came to my office some years ago and said, why would you go someplace other than the west end of the existing Allianz Marine Terminal? So their idea, and one that, according to Bechtel estimates, would save $2 to $3 billion on the construction cost rather than going to a greenfield location, which is the next option. The Yukon Pacific Corporation looked at Anderson Bay, just 5 miles down the bay from the Alyeska Marine Terminal. They did a lot of work as far as engineering, technical work on that site. That site was permitted by FERC and DOE as an export license, and FERC for a terminal siting permit. Again, those permits are not, you know, I want to be clear, those permits are not valid today. They were permitted at one time for that site location.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
That was with the anticipation of an export terminal for LNG?
That's correct.
Okay, all right. And this was before the Exxon Valdez spill?
It was about the time of the Exxon Valdez spill.
And I'm just trying to get a time frame in my mind because the EIS probably would be significantly different now. So it would be kind of a greenfield operation at Anderson Bay, do you think?
Anderson Bay was a greenfield because there's nothing right now. There's nothing there in the way of development. Allianz Marine Terminal.
Trying to get it.
Would be the brownfield.
All right. Thank you.
The next slide, I sort of stole this from a presentation in Rome at the World LNG Summit, but I thought it told the story so well, I like to use it. They called it the spaghetti slide, and as you'll see, that's exactly what it is. It shows the locations of moving LNG from supply to demand. I had the opportunity to spend some time in Norway a while back and went to the LNG terminal, the Snøhvit facility at Hammerfest, and they explained to me that they can get LNG to the Asian market by going through two canals. If they get past the Somalian pirates, they can deliver their cargo. So it's not quite like we have out of Alaska. As you can see, it's a pretty straight shot. And of course, we have the longest recorded history of on-time LNG shipments out of Nikiski since October of 1969. So we have a pretty gold-plated reputation in the market. Some time ago, the Port Authority said, let's have somebody else look at this project. We've looked at it so many times. Let's have somebody else look at it. Let's hire somebody. We interviewed Gas Strategies out of London, Bentec out of Denver, and Wood Mackenzie out of Houston. Selected Wood Mackenzie because of their world gas model and asked them three questions. Do an analysis on LNG out of Alaska and find out, is it competitive? What would the cost be? Does the state make any money at it? Because we've always sort of heard different versions. And then we said, in doing your analysis, don't use the work that Bechtel did for us. Don't use our work. Please use the off-the-shelf numbers. And I said, if you find two numbers for something, please use the higher number. Don't do us any favors by going out and trying to find the lowest number of something. If there's two or three numbers, use the highest. And they did. But it told an interesting story when they got done. I don't think I've been through a presentation anywhere in the world on oil and gas that didn't have Wood Mackenzie involved in some way. So they're certainly a world recognized entity. And so in comparing us to other projects, we did well. They had a delivered price of $850 into Japan. Other projects such as Kitimat in British Columbia, $1176. So our numbers came out fine. The next slide shows the workup of how you get to the $850. I have copies of the Wood Mackenzie, the full study with me if anybody would like a copy. We did distribute it to the legislature when it came out. It told a pretty positive story about LNG out of Alaska. This is the workup of the how they get to $850. The most significant number is the first three numbers, the 26 cents, the 22.22, and $1.70 came from the TransCanada their first open season in 2010. The balance of the numbers came from work that Bechtel had done. Liquefaction is the highest cost in the world. They didn't They didn't cut any slack for us on the liquefaction. We think that about a dollar could come off of that, maybe $1.50, but $8.50 we were fine with that, with their analysis. They did a financial model. We have a very significant model we've given in this building, and it takes about 8 hours to give, and we aren't going to give that today, but it's, we have looked at this very thoroughly with our financial consultants. The projection from Wood Mackenzie, they felt that the revenues to the state on, under their model, their projection of oil prices was in the range of between $220 and $419 billion over the life of the project, 30-year life. We thought that was a fairly significant number. This comes from one of the pages of their presentation and the executive summary, certainly one worth looking at. Over the years, gas has sort of been kind of a stepchild to oil. And so the question that we posed was, does it make any money? And it does appear to make money. In fact, on under their model, the revenues to the state from gas exceeds the revenues projected from oil in about year three and continue to climb after that. So,
Mr. Chairman.
And this is for a 2.7.
Excuse me, okay. Bill. Senator Cargill.
So 2.7
ECF
okay.
per day.
And this is the assumption. I'm going back to the last couple of slides. The assumption is 100% state ownership, Bill?
Under their model, it was not. Under the Wood Mackenzie model, it was not. It was private sector ownership model.
Kind of similar to what we were looking for under the TransCanada?
Similar to that, yes, okay. Senator.
Question.
Senator Machicki.
What commodity price were they using for Henry Hub versus Alaska LNG? I didn't find that on the slide.
Yeah, Senator Machicki, through the chair, the price they used was the price in Asia of $14, as far as the market price.
What about commodity feedstock price on this side? Do you know what they used for those?
I believe they used at the wellhead, I believe they used $2.
And used Henry Hub at the time in 2011 for the lower 48 comparisons?
They did not do a lower 48. They did do a lower 48 comparison. Some of those slides do reflect that. You know, I'd have to look in the, Senator, I'd have to look at the model to see what exact number they used for Henry Hub. It was whatever the market price was. I think it was probably in the $3 range, I think, at that point. A significant difference we have with the shale gas is that our shipping cost is 59 cents versus the Gulf Coast is in the low $3 on shipping costs. By the time you go down through the long journey, the Panama Canal. I sat on a presentation, and they said that when the Panama Canal is widened, don't expect any savings because the cost of going through the canal will be very similar to your cost of going around the Horn. So we think that competitive advantage for Alaska will remain. A lot of questions about, is there an Asian market? And you know, some have said that the Port Authority of the last year has relegated itself to op-eds and presentations. Not correct. We spent a lot of time in the last year in the market. As I said before, it's the market's based upon relationships, and I think the one that proved that the most is Jeff Lowenfeld. I think he went there 25 or 30 times and established relationships and brought market folks here after here to Juneau. So we follow in his footsteps as we entered the market and presented the Alaska project. One of the things in my presentations in the Asian market was this slide here talking about the molecular, the makeup, the BTU content of the gas. The rooms in Tokyo and Seoul, Korea would go quiet as they would study this slide. They like it very much. They like the high BTU content of gas and not have to bring in the propanes to spike the BTU content. They are very pleased with the liquids that are in the North Slope gas. This slide came from the AGEA process. The state of Alaska provided this slide to all those that participated in the AGEA process, and that was a snapshot of the BTU makeup at the time. High BTU content when you bring the liquid to tidewater, probably one of our strongest advantages, in addition to the fact that we are a cold climate and we're close to the market. So over the past year and a half, we've entered into various agreements with different companies. We've received letters of interest, we've received confidentiality agreements, we've received memorandum of agreements in the Asian market that said we'd very much like to have LNG out of Alaska. East West Power is a subsidiary of KEPCO. KEPCO is the government power generator in Korea, the largest government power generator in Korea by a significant margin.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Yeah, I really appreciate this because I think this is going to be the market for gas. So from letters of interest, where do we go next? So there needs to be an investment strategy. I don't know if I haven't looked at the slides coming up, but letters of interest always get me excited. And so what's the next step?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, the next step after letter of interest typically has been a memorandum of agreement. The next agreement typically is a project development agreement. But then also you want to at some point participate in an open season. We were fortunate that along this process we had an opportunity to join in an open season and participate in one. So they wanted to find out. So that's sort of the next step to find out is there a way of getting it from Prudhoe Bay to the market. Most projects around the world start here, start at the market, and work backwards, and then they select a port of export, and then some actually then go and look for the gas. Most have the gas, but some don't. So this is a critical step in it, absolutely, to have the market. And that's what keeps us kind of in the games, so to speak, because if the market ever said, we have no interest in anything from Alaska, I probably wouldn't be sitting in front of you taking up your valuable time. But that's not been the story from the market. It's been just the opposite. And so...
And Mr. Chairman, I agree with you. And we have this, the AGEA line that had an open season that never did get beyond that. We have the Pipeline Authority now, Alaska Pipeline, I'm sorry. And we have the ASAP line. Heading towards an open season. So we'll find out, won't we? But I just wanted to know, you haven't gotten beyond the letter of interest at this point.
We have. With some we have, Senator, through the chair.
Oh, really?
We have gotten beyond that.
Okay. Thank you.
The next is I'll just go through these slides quickly. GS Energy, another very large company in South Korea that is energy distribution business. POSCO is one of the largest, it is the largest steel manufacturer in Asia. A group of POSCO representatives came to Anchorage, met with us in September with the board. We communicate with them on a pretty much a daily basis about the status of what's happening, status of the open season, what's going on in Alaska. Very, very interested in LNG out of Alaska. KOGAS, many meetings with KOGAS in Korea. We've received a letter of intent from KOGAS. Very excited about LNG. That was the longest meeting I've ever been in without a break. We sat down about 4 hours later than we were done with our discussion for our first initial meeting. They were very interested in Alaska. PPT International, the government company out of Thailand, expressed an interest in participating in the open season that was held in September under AGEA.
Mr. Walker. I just wanted to comment that if you enjoy long meetings, you should hang around Juneau more this year.
PGN out of Indonesia expressed an interest in participating in the solicitation of interest from Exxon and TransCanada in September, and we included them as well. So we received this, as everybody received this, solicitation of interest for September 14th for an open season from Prudhoe Bay to South Central Alaska. We were pleased on the timing of that. We went to each of the companies we'd been working with and said, here's an open season opportunity. Would you like to participate? And they all said, we absolutely would like to participate. So we did. We submitted a nomination on September 14th for the open season that was held under AGEA. The companies, we made our nominations public just because there's been a lot of discussion about whether it should be public or not. We did because we felt that we sort of suffered from not knowing what was going on. So the combination, I can't show the exact of each company's nomination, but the total was 2.8 BCF. We call our target was 2.7 with in-state use of a 250 MCF. It takes over 3 BCF on the nomination of the open season. All we know is what we nominated. We don't know what else was nominated at that open season because it's not been made public. We do, and one of the not all the companies nominated a volume of the 2.8. So we know that it would be more likely to be higher than significantly higher than the 2.8.
So, Mr. Chairman, so I know some of these folks have invested in other LNG projects. Did they say at this interest there was cash available or financing available? Because I guess that's what's going to drive this show, right?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, every one of these companies has invested in other projects all over the world. None of them are going to put all their emphasis necessarily in one particular project. So their interest is buying at the wellhead. Their interest is not buying necessarily at the outlet. They want to be involved at the upstream, as far upstream as they can be. But they are all involved in other projects, absolutely.
And I guess that kind of brings to the question, and I guess that's always been one of the barriers, is how to get the major companies to work with you as a organizer, basically, because that's how I see your position, unless you think I'm off, is just organizing, getting your gas from the supplier and selling it to the marketer, and managing the pipeline. It's kind of how I see your role.
Yeah, Senator Coghill, through the chair, the mission of the Port Authority is to build or cause it to be built. So it's not a matter of saying, you know, we have to do everything. If we can cause it to be built, you know, as we've said, we would buy champagne as it goes by. We'd have no problem with that. But the key has been acquiring the gas. So that's why the interest has been buying at the wellhead. I mean, BP has said during the GA hearings in writing that they'd be happy to sell at the wellhead if somebody came along because the leases do require that. So it's not a matter of these companies are willing to roll their sleeves. They definitely want to be involved in the liquefaction piece, on an ownership piece, and they'd be happy to be involved in the pipeline piece as well. That's becoming sort of more of the model worldwide, is that the off-taker is involved in the upstream equity role in the projects.
Can I please just wanted to make sure the panel understood there's a big difference between non-binding solicitation and an open season. If you can cover that, please, so we don't the proof is in the pudding of when folks are willing to sign on to a 20 or 30 year commitment versus chatting about it right now.
Senator Michiki, the chair, thank you for that clarification. That's absolutely correct. Letter of intent, letter of interest is basically saying we're interested. Every project starts out there, but that doesn't mean you don't take letters of intent, letters of interest to the bank. But you do sit down and have further negotiations with them, and we have. We went deep into negotiations with Mitsubishi Corporation, you know, for years, and they invested money into this effort, whatnot. So, but they all start with the first, the letter of intent, and it's non-binding. It just says, hey, we're interested in what you're doing. We may or may not like to go to the next level. Most of them have gone to the next level. A few days following the open season in September 14th, an article came out, actually not a few days, about a month later, a company also nominated out of Japan, who we're not familiar with, Resource Energy Inc. Consortium, they nominated at the open season 2.7 BCF at the same open season that we nominated 3.05. So there you have a total nomination at the open season that we know of, just the two entities that did make it public. Maybe there's more beyond that. A 5.75 BCF billion cubic feet of gas. A 48-inch line with maximum compression, according to Bechtel's calculations, can bring 5.9 down. So we have, you know, all the slides on Wood Mackenzie is based on half of this volume. So you can take some of their numbers, and you can't double all of them, but it shows that there's a significant market out there, and they're interested in Alaska. You know, for them to step up, even if it is absolutely a non-binding open season, they're putting a name out there saying we're interested in this much volume moving, you know, buying it off the North Slope. So it's a strong interest in the Asian market. Here's the competition, you know, Qatar, Papua New Guinea is adding additional trains. Australia I've got more projects going on than anywhere in there. They're going to probably surpass Qatar as far as exports of LNG, the Gulf Coast, the Golden Pass. You know, projects are being built all over the world. So one question I have frequently received in the marketplace, I get done with the presentation, they say, why has Alaska continued to put yourself in the back of the queue? Why are you not out being more aggressive? Why are we just now hearing about this? We've not heard about this project. So the message I receive and I pass on to you as members of this committee is we need to hurry. And there really is, I mean, others are not studying it or thinking about it. They're welding steel and laying pipelines and building LNG tankers. So we need to be aggressive on this and not sit back and wait. Just real briefly on some of the slides associated with one of the studies that was done was in-state, what impact would a large volume line with the liquids have on gas prices in Alaska. We couldn't afford to analyze every city, so we took two. A clear, easy one was Fairbanks, just because of the road system and the pipeline coming through Fairbanks. And the second one was Bethel. What would it do for someone who's completely off the road system, off the grid? Fairbanks energy costs, the consultant came up with 80% reduction. Bethel was somewhere between 25 and 65% reduction in cost of energy. And that was assuming it was on small LNG barges out of Valdez to Bethel to replace the diesel generation that they have, and that could be done on any coastal city in Alaska.
Oh, how would that work, by shipping LNG over? Is that what you're thinking?
Out of Valdez over from Valdez to Bethel.
So, like building a holding facility over there, like a storage tank that we're talking about up in the interior, and. So the economics of that would prove out that close, you think?
That was their analysis. Now, again, I have copies of their study as well. We hired folks that this is what they do day in and day out, rather than us sort of figure it out ourselves. We had somebody else do it.
We've heard talk about them building a pipeline from South Central all the way up to the Donlin Creek to save energy for the mine up there. So my guess is this would be something they did want to look at.
That's correct. Senator Egan.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So did you do any studies on how it would benefit the 70,000-plus residents of the Panhandle, Southeast?
We did.
Did they look at that at all?
The benefit to Southeast would be the revenues to the state. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of revenue that would come from this project to the state.
But we'd get no energy.
You could. You could. If you could get there cheaper than your hydro, certainly could. In fact, I've spent time with the Ketchikan shipyard folks in Ketchikan, going through and showing what they've done elsewhere in the world, in Norway, as far as putting LNG on small barges and moving them about their country. We could do the same here and certainly move it to Southeast if it was more economic than the hydroelectric. And also, they certainly like the idea of building the barges and the small vessels there in Ketchikan. So I think there would be good benefit to Ketchikan.
Thank you. Continue, please.
At this point, I'm gonna turn it over to Craig Richards and for him to go through a number of slides and again, any questions you have to.
Thank you, Bill, Mr. Bishop. So I was going to cover two topics today. The first topic was where are we bottlenecking at a large pipeline, and the second one was advantages of a large line versus a bullet line. I practiced my presentation this morning, and there's no way I'm going to get to the second topic. So we're going to focus on why is a large project bottlenecking, and why has it been bottlenecking and not moving forward for the last decade or two? So as Bill discussed, when you look at the ingredients for a large project, and by a large project, I mean a large diameter project from North Slope to South Central, Cook Inlet, Valdez, all of the major components of a project look like they're in place. You've got gas is available, unlike a lot of LNG projects that are moving forward that Bill discussed. You've got 30 to 35 TCF of proven reserves, plus a lot more known resources that have not been fully delineated. As Bill also stated, Asian market demand in the most recent solicitation of interest was double the full capacity of an LNG line, of a three-train project. So we have double the market demand than we could probably even put into place on a first 48-inch pipe, or at least a three-train project. According to World Mac, the LNG economics out of Alaska are not only solid, they're the best of any LNG project in the world that's not going forward, that hasn't started the construction phase. And finally, for an Alaska LNG project, there don't appear to be any significant regulatory hurdles. For a long time, there was talk about could we get an export license, but with the change in the natural gas supply in the lower 48, it seems pretty much as a matter of course that just as YPC got an export license back in the late 80s, early 90s, that a large LNG project is going to get one today. So why is a large project not moving forward? Well, I think what I'm going to try to demonstrate over the next couple slides, and it's not really a point that I think will be refuted, is that the North Slope producers do not want a project to move forward until they are comfortable with what they call fiscal certainty. That is, they want to get fiscal terms arranged in a manner that is acceptable to them before they go to the next step of an LNG project. And consequently, they won't build a project themselves, and they won't sell gas to someone else that would build a project until such time as their demands are met. And I'll start with this first quote here, and I ran across this just in the recent book on Exxon that Steve Cole did. And this was from the mid-90s, and it was a discussion he had with Lee Raymond, and that's the CEO of Exxon at the time. Exxon had opportunities to exploit oil and natural gas in Alaska, but held back from expensive deals because Raymond had learned, after the Valdez oil spill, that the political risks posed by Alaska's frontier-minded political culture and populist governors were comparable to those of West Africa. So what the CEO of Exxon is telling you is that Exxon's nervous about investing here. They feel like if they put in a bunch of money in another project like TAPS, that they run the risk of the government changing fiscal terms on them. And you see that in their behavior in Point Thompson. They don't want to do significant investment in Point Thompson, and they don't want to invest in a natural gas pipeline until they get the fiscal structure that they want. And this is exactly what Marty Massey told this body when he testified in 2007 during the GEA process. And that's basically that Exxon is willing to accept geological risk, they're willing to accept commodity price risk, they're willing to accept cost overrun risk, but what they're not willing to risk before they invest in Alaska or before they sell at the wellhead is fiscal certainty risk. They're not willing to risk the state of Alaska changing terms on them in the future if a deal is reached. And this was confirmed, of course, in the letter that the governor got from the three CEOs in March. Same statement that you've been hearing since the mid-1990s, that before the producers move forward with the project, they want fiscal certainty. And then most recently, again, in October, again from the letter that was the project update from the Alaska Pipeline Project. And I'll read this one. A healthy long-term oil business underpinned by a competitive fiscal framework and LNG project fiscal terms that also address AGEA issues, is required to monetize North Slope gas resources. So this is Conoco, BP, and Exxon telling the state of Alaska that before we move forward with the project, not only do we need fiscal certainty, but we have to change some of the terms of AGEA they don't like. So the first gate that Alaska has to go through, at least to get the producers on board with the project, is fiscal certainty. So I thought it would be helpful to lay out to the committee what fiscal certainty is, or at least what it has been in the past. And in particular, what the producers want is they want tax and royalty concessions on both oil and gas. One of the hallmarks of the requirements in the past before they'll move forward with the pipeline project is that they not only want a structure on gas taxes that they like, they want a structure on oil taxes that they like. And they don't just want the tax deal that they like, they also want that to be locked in for the life of the project. They want it so that Alaska can't get in and sort of turn the knobs after the project's under construction to change the fiscal deal. And of course, there's the way they want to do that is by redefining Alaska's relationship with the producers. Currently, Alaska is both a project partner in the terms of the contractual entity that owns Prudhoe Bay, but we are also the sovereign government, which gives us not only the contractual rights of an owner, but it gives us the sovereign rights of a government. And what the producers want through fiscal certainty is they want to realign away from sovereignty towards a purely contractual arrangement, or not purely, but one that much more closely reflects a contractual arrangement. And this is the approach that the big three, particularly Exxon, take around the world. When they have a sovereign government that they don't view as stable, what they do is they try to get decisions, they try to put a contract in place that has decision-making made in the contract, and then review occurring in international arbitration, sort of removal of sovereignty from local decision-making, and basically puts a deal in place that they feel they can move forward with. So in Alaska, we know the producers want fiscal certainty before they're going to move forward with a project or before they're going to sell at the wellhead. So what does fiscal certainty look like? Well, luckily, we know. We at least know what fiscal certainty looked like in the past, and in the relatively recent past at that. So in 2006, these were the provisions that fiscal certainty required for the North Slope producers to allow a project to move forward. And they're all the hallmarks that if you've been doing this for a long time, you see in all of these discussions. No regulatory jurisdiction by the RCA. They want the contract that they enter into to trump state sovereignty. then with the state of Alaska to be forced to take the royalty in kind on the slope. They want oil and gas taxes reduced and capped. They want to keep Point Thompson without meaningful development until such time as they view it as commercially favorable. They don't want Alaska courts to have jurisdictions over disputes. And they want to keep as much confidential as possible. And then a generous force majeure clause. And if you look at the articles in red, these are the articles by the Stranded Gas Development Act contract. And again, because that exists, we know pretty much what the terms are, at least 6 years ago, of what the producers want for fiscal certainty. The articles in red are similar requirements that got embedded into the Point Thompson Settlement Agreement. The Point Thompson Settlement Agreement was very much a Stranded Gas Development Act contract that addressed Point Thompson without addressing the tax issues. So we basically know what fiscal certainty looks like. Now, I think what we're going to see in the next 6 months to a year is the administration coming forward with a fiscal deal. It may take the form of a contract, like Governor Murkowski's did, or it may take the form of a series of bills that address all of these issues, not in a contract form, but as individual bills on an individual basis. And as the producers in the quotes I read demonstrate, this is the simple decision tree that the ANS lessees are going to follow to move a gas pipeline forward. So before they commence significant technical work, they want fiscal certainty, and then they'll do the technical work. By the technical work, I mean FEED, basically, the front-end engineering and design work. And then after that is done, and the numbers have been built up, and the cost estimates are in place, and they've had the opportunity to negotiate some of the commercial arrangements, then you'll have a commercial decision, and then you'll go to financial close. But the key to each of the gates of fiscal certainty, technical work, and ANS lessee decision commercial is that they're sequential gates. So because we haven't moved through the fiscal certainty gate, the North Slope producers are not going to actively pursue technical work, it looks like, until we do. So obviously the point of AGEA was to get around this problem, right? The point of AGEA was to bring in a white knight, someone to come in and effectively start doing the technical work and start advancing a project without resolving fiscal certainty. The people that were the architects of AGEA had been through the 2006 Stranded Gas Development Act process. They recognized that fiscal certainty was a problem, and achieving the terms that worked for the state through fiscal certainty didn't appear likely. So they had the idea of, well, if we bring in an independent pipeline company, we can find a way to get around the bottlenecking of gas development that's occurring out of the producer demand for fiscal certainty. So effectively, what the slide shows is what AGEA did is it moved the technical work in advance of the fiscal certainty issue. Well, ultimately, AGEA didn't work in that capacity. And when I say AGEA failed, I mean it failed as it was intended, which was a means to get around the producer control and demand for fiscal certainty. And I think AGEA failed for a couple of reasons. I think it failed because it was really geared towards a highway project. TransCanada, of course, had been the sponsors through Foothills of a highway project through Canada for many, many years, since the early 80s. Their entire application was geared towards the highway project. They mentioned LNG to Valdez, in two different paragraphs and, a couple of places and, 100-page plus application. So LNG was really sort of more of a cover your bases kind of thing. So that was a problem. The second problem is the state brought in TransCanada to, like I said, be their white knight and advance a project without the producers. Until such time as the producers wanted to get on board on the state's terms. A couple days after the AGEA license was awarded, I'm sure everyone recalls that Hal Kvisle was quoted as saying that nothing goes forward until Exxon is happy with it. So here's, sort of the independent pipeline company we'd brought in to try to advance a project without the producers to gain sort of leverage in the fiscal certainty negotiations. And they're saying that, at the end of the day, we're really not going to sort of take Exxon on. So, and that's really come to fruition here in the last couple of years, where the AGEA process that was meant to get around the producer control issue has now been completely co-opted by the ANS lessees. It's now essentially a producer project. And the final reason that I think AGEA failed, and why it was probably set up for failure, you never know how life's going to turn, and obviously shale gas seriously changed the nature of how AGEA was going to work. But sort of the problem with the AGEA approach is that it moved the technical work above fiscal certainty in terms of how you deal with it, but it did it without really addressing the need for fiscal certainty. It was a permanent and they will come approach. So this is exactly what YPC tried in the 90s and in the late 80s, which is if we get all the permits in place, then maybe that will make a pipeline happen. And of course it doesn't, because at the end of the day, the producers have the gas, and until such time as they're willing to sort of come to the table with the gas, or the state exercises another option, having the permits in place and doing the techno work doesn't really solve the problem and the bottleneck that the state's faced for a lot of years now. So I think this is going to be my last slide here. And as we go forward over the next year and we look at fiscal certainty, the state kind of has two options, I think, at the highest level. Maybe there are others, but there's two that I recognize. And the first option is, do we enter into a deal with the North Slope producers? I think everyone recognizes that if a deal could be reached with the North Slope producers that was acceptable to Alaska, that would be great. That a project could then move forward to the technical work and maybe a commercial lessee decision. I think the problem that we're going to run into in the next year or two as the producers come forward with their fiscal package is it's going to look pretty similar to what was in the 2006 Stranded Gas Development Act contract. Maybe some things will change, maybe some things will be taken out, maybe some things will be added. We don't know till it comes forward. But fiscal certainty as presented in 2006 wasn't acceptable to the state. The Stranded Gas Development Act deal wasn't acceptable to the legislature because it wasn't a particularly good deal for the state. So when it comes to you again, it's going to be coming to you in an environment that is particularly less favorable to provide fiscal certainty, at least as it's previously been asked for. In 2007, oil prices were at $50 a barrel. Since then, oil prices have doubled, and ACES has been enacted, and state take has gone from about $3.7 billion in 2006 to about $8 billion now. So I think what you're going to see is that the fiscal proposals that come forward, that merely the fiscal certainty requested in oil tax reductions are going to exceed the value of gas pipeline development to the state treasury for a long time. Because if the fiscal deal that the producers want looks anything like it's looked like in the past with the reduced oil taxes as part of the deal, the cost of that is going to be likely prohibitive unless, again, there's a change in what the producers want. So that's my first conclusion. And so the second conclusion is, what do you do about it? So what AGEA tried to do is AGEA tried to get someone else to advance a project without the requirement for fiscal certainty. That was the intended purpose of it, and it didn't work out as the state had hoped. Well, what I think and what I believe the Port Authority thinks the state needs to do is the state needs to take control of the project itself. It needs to align with the market itself without the producers. It needs to begin the technical work without the producers until such time as the producers are willing to commit to a project without demanding fiscal certainty. And I'm not going to go into it here, but I think one of the things that, for instance, the Alaska Standalone Pipeline Project has been doing right is that they have been doing that. They haven't been allowing fiscal certainty to bottleneck technical development. So I think that as you look at the fiscal certainty discussion that's going to occur in the next year, you begin to think, are we going to really provide fiscal certainty on terms that are acceptable to the producers? And is it in our interest to do so? And what is the alternative to that? And how do we advance a project without the North Slope producers? And of course, as Bill discussed, practically what that means is it means the state requires gas to be sold at the wellhead, and it brings in other international companies with the same kind of balance sheets to take on the project development role that BP and Exxon would take if they got the fiscal certainty deal they wanted. Any questions?
Gentlemen, questions?
I have one.
Senator Michiki.
So on the subject of fiscal certainty, and on slide 34, you compared articles that had similar provisions in the Point Thompson settlement.
Right.
Constitutionally speaking, is it fair to say that Article 8 through 13 and Articles 23 through 35 relatively easy to settle constitutionally, and Article 14 through 21, with the exception of two of them, would be more difficult to settle?
So from a purely constitutional perspective, taking out the politics and whether it's a good deal, I think that's accurate. And I think the point you're making very astutely is that things that are the contractual rights the state has, the terms of its royalty, the terms of, you know, the various contractual arrangements on the North Slope, those are things the state has the power to cut a long-term deal on. Articles 14 through 21 represent essentially changing a tax structure, which the legislature can do, but then locking in that change for, you know, some period of time, the life of the project maybe. And of course, that's the rub on fiscal certainty, is that the state constitution explicitly prohibits contracting away the power to tax. The state cannot agree to lock in taxes today and not change them in the future under the constitution.
So in your discovery phase, have you been able to identify an effective way for that to be done, to deliver that fiscal certainty? Because I are just in my limited amount of research, it's tough.
I don't think it can be done. And I think that that's maybe a point that I was trying to make, is that if the North Slope producers demand that particular element, we can't give it to them. So we have to look to alternatives.
Question. So would one of those alternatives be the state being an interest working partner?
Senator Bishop, certainly it would be one option. I guess after the years we've spent working meetings in Houston with the producers, probably most predominantly with Exxon, I think the problem is that, you know, we're trying to get someone to do something that may not be in their best interest, but it's absolutely in our best interest. So whether or not we're a partner, I don't think we should be a minority partner. Around the world, the model is more in Qatar. It's 70% the government of Qatar, 30% the leaseholder, or in a combination either of Exxon, Conoco, and others, or just Exxon in some particular fields. But the norm is that the government is the has a predominant role in the infrastructure development, because the government wants to determine what market it goes to and when. And you know, when I look at our population of 650,000 people, and compared to when I'm walking the streets of Seoul, Korea, with 11 million people, we need a bigger market, and we need to take control of that opportunity. It's surprising to me, every meeting I've been in Japan and Korea, I inquired as to, you know, what have you heard about Alaska's gas at the end of the presentation? Have you heard presentation from the our leaseholders on this? And not a single one ever acknowledged that they had. We're just not on the field. We're just absolutely not on the field. To quote a friend of mine, we're stuck in study hall on this issue and not actually getting the job done. They, you know, we are fortunate to have the producers we have in Alaska. Don't get me wrong. They've done. I mean, I was born here. I've known how far we've come. But they have projects all over the world, and that's because they're big successful companies. We don't. Alaska does not. So I really liken the you know, sitting back trying to incentivize and fiscal certainty on the pipeline. It would be like us trying to incentivize, you know, Carlisle, Linden, Salvador Express to build a highway system. You know, that's not what they do. They haul freight on the highway, and that's why the Port Authority has been a long supporter of the state of Alaska stepping up and being involved as the owner. The president of Sempra Energy was adamant about that. He said, you're going to pay for it one way or the other. You're going to pay for it in fiscal certainty, which would be far exceed if you ever get to fiscal certainty. I certainly agree with Senator Machicki on whether or not you can even get there. Why are you doing that? I mean, you know, Wood Mackenzie on a pipeline that is half capacity of 2.7, 220 to $400 billion. We have an open season. It's double that volume, nearly the 5.9, and we're sitting back waiting for more announcements and waiting for somebody else to step up and do what's best for Alaska. And so we really do urge the Alaska, you know, the leadership of Alaska, the legislature of Alaska, to recognize. I mean, I'm sort of surprised we aren't having hearings about AGIA here. I mean, we've put $500 million on the table, and we haven't seeing the results of the 2010 open season. The only reason you see anything on this open season is because we presented it to you. We nominated, we went to the market, we brought it, we showed it to you. And somebody in an interview in the Anchorage Daily News, I don't like to get all my information from the media necessarily, but I did that time, and they nominated 2.7. Well, there it is. I mean, what more do we have to do to show that, you know, we brought a continued from Mitsubishi Corporation to Juneau 1 week after the Fukushima earthquake, and met with the Senate leadership. We met with the Commissioner of DNR for 2 days, a very, very good meeting with them. And they sat, they came, they listened, they went right from here to British Columbia, put in $1 billion with Shell and an LNG project. They went on the Gulf Coast, invest another $1 billion. They're ready to do business. And we seem to be sitting back, waiting for, you know, living from announcement to announcement to announcement, while the world literally is passing us by. So I guess the message we're saying is, you know, announcements are one thing, but putting a project together that's market based, that has the economics, is not a build it and they'll come. You tie up these markets, you know, well in advance. You know, if we can walk the streets of Seoul, Korea, and Tokyo, and sign up customers for 5.5 BCF of gas, goodness, you think the state of Alaska could be doing that? And we're very pleased that we've seen the administration, we've seen the governor, we've seen the commissioner making the trips to Japan. We think that's a very good start. But boy, we need to move a little more aggressive as far as what we're going to do.
Bill, follow up question: were you surprised or by the number that the majors put out for the total construction cost of the pipeline, or were they in line with the modeling numbers that Wood Mac give you?
Senator Bishop, they were in line with the modeling numbers that Wood Mackenzie used. But let me just say something about that. You know, when I was in the Asian market, they would bring that up, and they would say, you know, this. Then they would bring up the $65 billion number and say, can you compete? Well, Gorgon, Australia is way over $50 billion right now on a project that's not done, for a project that's approximately half the size we're talking about. And you don't hear, and that's still continuing to progress. So, you know, you have to look around the world and see what else is happening around the world. And sometimes numbers are thrown out there for a couple of reasons. Sometimes it's to deter another project. So people have hung on to the $65 billion. There's also a $45 billion as part of that as well. But they don't talk about the fact that our cold climate makes our project 40% more efficient than Gorgon, Australia, because it's 110 degrees there, and it's about 40 degrees in Valdez on an ambient temperature basis. Those are big issues on LNG analysis. So, you know, we did use those numbers. I'm sorry, Senator, I tend to wander a bit from that question. Wood Mackenzie did use those numbers, and I don't shy away from those numbers. I think they're aggressively high, and I think they're aggressively high for a reason.
Any more questions,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks again. Good to see you both. So, just trying to figure out how we break through the bottleneck. Looking at slide 34, we've been through the Stranded Gas Act issue. There are certain things that constitutionally we can't agree to, and I don't think the people of Alaska are willing to give up state sovereignty. Even if we could. So any suggestions on how do we break through the bottleneck here?
So Senator Bishop asked, Senator Wilkowski through the chair, Senator Bishop asked a great question of should the state take an ownership role? Well, I think, again, at a high level, there's two different things the state could do along that path. The first is to act as the project developer. You know, a project developer will come in and put a project together, but not necessarily take an equity stake. Whether the state comes in, the state needs to take that role on. The state needs to contact the market, they need to identify the market, they need to negotiate gas purchase contracts on the North Slope with the Asian buyers, they need to take them to the producers, and they say, take them, or you know, you're going to get in problems under your leases. Because the North Slope producers do not have the legal right to withhold gas production, to not market product, if they've got a chance of making money. They don't get to hold the spigot closed because they're trying to gain leverage on taxes or they're trying to gain leverage on other contractual terms. It's a direct violation of their leases, and they know it, and they won't do it. But they're not going out and seeking the market. They're not advancing the project because they know they want fiscal certainty. So the state needs to be in that project developer role. It needs to be working with the independent pipeline construction companies. It needs to be working with the Asian buyers on the liquefaction plant. Like I said, identify the market and work on negotiating the gas purchase agreements. And the whole time, as it's moving the project forward, at any point if the producers want to jump on board without demanding fiscal certainty, that's great. But at the end of the day, we can't sit around waiting for them asking for something we can't give them.
If follow up, or, yeah, Senator Machiki, go ahead.
Senator Machiki.
I think an important thing has been stated here, and it's one of the struggles that occurred before the TAPS line was built. The numbers are always somewhat daunting, but the visionaries that built TAPS created our current economy, and it's difficult to move folks beyond that large of a scale. But one of the key things you pointed out today is that there is a market. It's unlikely that that market will diminish significantly, and we'd enjoy various commodity prices through the years, but when you fund something over 30 plus years, it literally does deliver a number two industry to Alaska that we currently don't have. So the key to moving forward, and certainly looking at the prize at the end of the rainbow, and I know you're going to talk about the AGDC discussion moving forward, if it continues to be difficult on a larger diameter line, is it likely that you'll look at supporting a smaller diameter line that's less economical in the future that delivers energy to Alaskans at a fair price?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, you know, we're not going to go into much detail on AGDC today, just partly because of lack of time, but let me just say this. I would really hope, let me just back up. You know, in the early 50s, Canada had a similar situation. They had all their gas in Alberta and all their people in Toronto. And they did for 3 years what we've done for 30 years, or 40 years, depending on when you want to start counting. And after 3 years of arguing about routes and who's going to do the pipeline, who this, that, you know, thing, Parliament said, stop. We need to get our gas to our people. And they took it over, and they did it themselves. Parliament took it over. They hired the contractors. They built it. And the government of Canada owned that pipeline, the Trans-Canadian pipeline, for one day, for 24 hours. And they sold it to TransCanada. That's how TransCanada got started. It's not inappropriate for it. So I guess my hope is that if the producers don't come through with something that and ask for fiscal certainty, which we cannot give under our Constitution, our default isn't go to a what I would call a failed opportunity, a failed project, because it doesn't put a single dime in the state coffers. It might it be good for some reasons, but don't step away from the project that is staring us in the face with the market opportunity just because some companies have said it's not in their best interest. It's not in their best interest. It's in our best interest. So I would ask you to not step away from this opportunity just because, you know, three companies that are leaseholders in the North Slope say we're asking for something that you can't, well, quite honestly, under our Constitution, give to them. So you know, I just... The concern is that we're going to accept failure because we're not willing to step up and do what's right. You know, the most notable meeting that took place in this city for Alaska, I believe, took place in October of 1973 when Governor Egan called the producers to Juneau by telegram and said, you meet me here in Juneau. He didn't go to Houston. He didn't go to London. He said, you come here. He sat them down and said, gentlemen, the state of Alaska is going to build the Trans-Alaska oil pipeline ourselves. We're going to own it. You're not. And he went to the legislature and had that discussion. A big fight ensued. Construction started shortly after that because the state stood up and said, this is what we're going to do because it's best for us, rather than sit back and wait for you to argue about fiscal certainty. Did they want fiscal certainty then? You bet they did. But the governor stood up and said, he said, we're going to do it ourselves so we can get around that. That's what we need to do. That's the only way we're going to advance this, is if we step up and follow the mandate of the Constitution rather than try to change the Constitution for someone, you know, that's asking for something we can't give to them. So I really would, without going into a lot of detail on the other options, the best option is the large volume, the one that's market-based. We have a world-class opportunity from the North Slope and from Alaska. And let's match that with a world opportunity on the marketplace. We've brought to you and shown you what we've done over the last year with the market. It's they're there. They're very interested in Alaska. They're very confused by Alaska. They have told me, we know how to do business in Chad and the Upper Niger. We don't know how to do business in Alaska. So we need to change that. This is your opportunity to change that.
Thank you, Bill. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you.
We've got a few minutes. We're about done.
Okay, thank you. Real quick, can you just very briefly address when people talk about Alaska's competitiveness versus, say, the lower 48, where you have the explosion of cheap shale gas, do you still believe we can be competitive with them, number one? And second question is, the governor has laid out a series of parameters and guidelines that he's wanted the oil companies to follow. Can you talk about whether you think that works or doesn't work, and where we are in terms of what the governor has laid out.
Certainly, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, very briefly. Do we compete with shale gas? You bet we compete with shale gas. The shale gas is untested. Where's the 30 years or 40 years of experience? Compare shale gas to Nikiski. We've been shipping LNG out of Alaska for 40 years. When I go into Tokyo Gas and Tokyo Electric, they want to talk about conventional gas in Alaska. They don't want to talk about shale gas. Are they committing to buy shale gas? They just did the other day. Tokyo Electric with Sempra did. Of course they are. Our economics beat them. We beat them because of our shipping costs. Our cost to put it in the pipeline is 26 cents. Theirs is significantly different to get it into the pipeline, get it into facility. We have many advantages over the lower 48. Henry Hub was $13 in 2008. You know, people that want to index to Henry Hub have said, we're a little afraid of Henry Hub, you know, because it looks really good today, but in 2008 it was $13. So they like the conventional gas. The lower 48 does not have conventional gas. They like the associated gas. The lower 48 doesn't have associated gas. So we're sort of the blinking light out there as far as all the pluses of stability on a project. And then your second question, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, has to do with what the governor's laid out. And I guess after these years of seeing what's not happened, the failed starts, the different studies, the different attempts at doing something, we've done everything but step up and do it ourselves. And I guess that's the concern I have, is that the proposal still relies on somebody else to do what's best for Alaska. And only Alaskans can do what's best for Alaska. So I don't have a lot of optimism when we're relying upon somebody else to do what's in our best interest, because it may not be in their best interest. So I would hope that again, we're not going to be relying upon somebody else to step forward and do what we should be doing. We should follow we should learn the lessons of TAPS, and that was appropriate for the state to step up. We didn't have two nickels to rub together at that time in '73. We certainly do now. It's time we step up and advance this project and say we're not going to wait for more fiscal certainty discussion, more sessions when we can't change our constitution that shouldn't be changed.
Okay, any more questions? We're about out of time. Mr. Walker, Mr. Richards, I'd like to thank you guys for coming today. Probably won't be your last trip here before this committee, before session is over. We've got some other pipeline people in the queue coming forward, and I appreciate your presentation, and I look forward to stopping by today. Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator. And I'd like to mention that the committee, before we adjourn, our next meeting is on Thursday, February 14th. Gwen Holdman from the Alaska Center for Energy and Power from the University will be here giving us an update and overview of the research work that's going on within the university system. Thank you. We're adjourned.